there are options, but I think it's just a choice to say, I think I want to make a change. Gonna make a change.
I didn't know we were doing karaoke
for
today.
What's in my life.
Welcome to Women Your Mother Warned You About,
the podcast that makes business sexy again. I'm Rachel Pitts, mom, realtor, and creator of The Closing Curve.
And I'm Gina Tremarco, dog mom, because I never say that. Dog mom, founder and sales trainer at Pivot 10 Results and Carolina Improv. How's it going, Rachel?
Oh, you know, just another day in paradise. I mean, actually, literally, I do live in paradise. I live in Pawleys Island, South Carolina. And I, you know, when we live at the beach, you, Gina, are lucky enough to live within walking distance of the beach. Yeah. So you go to the beach. But a lot of locals, we don't always go there. But I did drive over to the beach the other day and I was like, oh, my God, it's so beautiful. So if you'd like to move to Pawleys Island, call me.
She's selling real estate.
I will sell you a beautiful house of paradise. Your slice of paradise, I like to call it. We've got a review to share today.
Ooh,
and I wanted to shout out to Alice. She signed on as Alice 5020. Or it might be a he. Could be like Alice Cooper kind of Alice. But Alice said, enjoyed listening. I'm enjoying the conversations you have. I thought the podcast on No was valuable for salespeople and also enjoyed Tom Ziegler's interview. So thanks for that, Alice.
Awesome. Thank you, Alice. And Warners, if you haven't given us a review yet, please go to our show on iTunes and do so. You can also easily access our iTunes page from our website, womenyourmotherwarnedyouabout.com. The more reviews we get, the more exposure and the greater we get. That sounds like a good... That's a good sell.
Could it get greater than it is right now?
No.
It always can be.
Yeah. Before we started recording, we were having you were having a passionate, and I was having a passionate listening to your passionate speaking about buyers and sellers. And I thought it was an interesting topic about the emotionality around it, because I had said, let's do an episode on emotional intelligence, since I've been doing a lot of training in that lately for clients. And I think it's kind of a good topic to dive into, because one thing I say in training is that, you know, buying is very emotional, but so is selling. So as a salesperson, there's a lot of emotion involved that gets you aggravated as a salesperson. And then there's a lot of emotion involved with the buyer. And when you were talking a couple minutes ago, I was like, oh, we need to talk about this from a real estate perspective and then some.
Well, let's start out with on the tail end of my rant, because
I wish I had been recording the rant, because the rant was really
right
good.
Well, here's what I'm running into that's frustrating me right now, and if you're in real estate, you probably can relate, and maybe other industries as well, is that most sellers, and I'm talking residential and my experience so far in commercial, they are always thinking about what they've put into, what their investment has been into their property. Now, I get that. Let's just use round numbers. If you bought your house at $200,000 and then you put another $50,000 over the life of living there, which might have been 10 years, of like new floors and then the granite countertops that you put in, and then you replace the windows and then all this. So the expectation is that you deserve to, you're entitled to, let's use the word, to get back out of that home the $250,000 that you've invested. That's what you want to get out of it. And that is fair. That's a fair assumption. However, if the pricing in the neighborhood, the homes around you are selling for $200,000, it doesn't matter how much you put into the house. It matters the comps around you that have sold in the last few months. And I had a great conversation with a female appraiser who, I want to get an interview with her, but she was just really, when she realized I wanted to record her, she was like, oh, But she said the same thing. She said it is so common in appraisals that people think that what the money they're spending inside of the house is going to affect how their home appraises. And the fact is, appraisers and buyers also don't give a shit about what you put into the house. They don't care. They're researching and trying to find out what your mortgage was and how much they can lowball you. Let's face it. But if all the homes in your area, in your direct neighborhood, and we're not talking outside of your neighborhood, because appraisers are going to look at the homes in your neighborhood. What have they sold for? What are they selling for currently? You know, what are the active listings and what's pending? That's what they're going to look at. And it doesn't matter if you think your home is better than everybody else's. Doesn't matter. They're going to take into account the square footage and if maybe you have a pool. But otherwise, no one cares if your countertops are nicer than the house next door. If it's a house in the same neighborhood that you're asking $250 and the same house down the road with the same exact square footage sold 2 weeks ago or 3 months ago for $199, then the buyers are going to come along and offer you $185 and see what you do. That's just how it happens from both sides of the coin. And likewise, buyers look at sellers, you know, homes that they want to purchase, and they're going, oh, well, those countertops are old. I'm going to offer less. Like, they still think that they can, but it becomes really emotional for me as the realtor, because I'm putting the facts on the table. I've got 10 years in the industry and I really do know how it works. And, you know, people think because they watch HGTV and that they saw the fucking Zestimate and they think they know better than me. And like, I appreciate the wonderful tool that Zillow is, and I love HGTV.
Zillow says it's worth so much more.
Oh my God, kill me now. But like, honestly, that is how it really works, ladies and gentlemen. Zillow, think of it this way. Zillow has all of the homes in all of America and probably beyond Canada. That data, that technology cannot update in real time, and a lot of times it's not accurate. So you can't really trust it as much as you can trust a human like me, who I actually can dig into the tax records, can dig into the MLS, which is in real time, and tell you what actually sold in your neighborhood. And I can also talk to other humans in the industry, and I can find out information, you know, from the other realtors, what's really going on, because there's always more to it.
And isn't there a point of value as well, right? So in any selling process, people are going to, they're going to purchase based on how they value something. So first there's the, here's the market value. And then there's the emotional value. I mean, I'm sure you've seen bidding wars, at least I see them on HGTV, where there's a bidding war on a house that sells for more than what the market value is, because there's something about that house that creates more value in the buyer's mind.
And also a really tricky trick that people hate to hear, but it works because I've done it, is if you want to create a bidding war, then look at the houses in your neighborhood and price below all of them. Especially if your house is superior to all the other homes for sale in your neighborhood, because that's exactly what I did. I took this house in this really coveted neighborhood that's between where I live and Charleston. A lot of people, you know, the Charleston market is out of hand, and people are they're moving, you know, buying houses a little north. So this house is a super duper adorable house, and I met with the seller and I said, look, your house is amazing and I think we should price it at the lowest price in the neighborhood, and I bet you we'll get a bidding war on it because it's superior in a lot of ways to the homes in the neighborhood. The view, the freaking cuteness factor, which was out, you know, off the charts. And she hated the idea. She was so pissed and she fought me all the way to the point. And then I said, why don't we just try it and see? And what happened was, I had, like, in less than 24 hours, I had four offers on the house and I had agents screaming at me over the phone of, wow, you know, wanting to get this house. Ended up, we sold the house for $20,000 more than we were asking.
Which is probably where she wanted to be.
Which was exactly where she would wanted to be. And she also, you know, went so far as to have the house appraised on her own, and we sold it for the appraised value. Because again, if you're going higher than what the house is going to appraise for, then whomever is coming along is not going to get,
they're not going to get
a mortgage. If you have your house priced $20,000 above what all the other homes in your area are selling for, it's not going to appraise, and you're going to have to sell it for market value anyways, because the banks are going to look at the appraisal and be like, no, we're not lending 20 grand above.
Right.
You know, or right. if the buyer wants it enough and they're willing to pay the difference to get the house, which in a hot market, sometimes they will do, but it's just, it's facts, people.
It's facts.
And the facts should work, but they don't. I mean, I've got like several listings and buyers right now where they're emotional about it. And I can put the facts on the table all day long, but they're like, yeah, but I don't know. I'm going to list it at this. And I'm like, okay. Because I want the listing anyways.
That's exhausting.
It is incredibly exhausting.
But again, the emotionality behind it, right, of anything, I think about when the market, you know, when the market had crashed and I had to sell property. When was this? 2009. I had to sell my property in Chicago. And I was devastated by it. I mean, I wasn't underwater, but it was so bad. I mean, I wasn't upside down, but I lost a ton of equity and I struggled with letting it go because I'm like, but I paid so much more. But the value changed.
The value changed. And also, you know, you have to think of it like, especially in a residence, you would have been paying, if you didn't have that house, you'd have been paying that amount of rent anyway. Like you would have, you know what I mean? Like there's ways to look at it. It's just, sometimes you're going to take a loss.
Yeah. Well, you know, I did. I was emotional and then I had to find a way to get practical to get myself out of the emotion. So what I did was I sat down and said, okay, if I hold on to this property and I wait for the market to turn, and everything everybody was saying was that it was going to be at least 5 years, maybe 10. That's what they were predicting. I think it came back less than 10, but definitely maybe 5. I don't know. You know better. But I did the numbers for 5 years. I'm like, if I pay the taxes and the HOA for the next 5 years and the mortgage, how much money will I spend? That actually is not going to be going into equity, right? It's not going to go into appreciation, right? Because HOA and taxes are not going to appreciate. So when I ran those numbers for 5 years, I'm like, okay, there's no way. There was no way that the market was going to go up fast enough to be back at what I paid for it to make sense for me to spend that kind of money for the next 5 years. And when I did that, I was like, oh, I'm so out of here. And then I was able to walk away from the emotions of it.
Right. And in the same vein, you know, if a seller is asking $20,000 above market value, and it's therefore going to sit there or get offers that get rejected, meanwhile, you're paying the mortgage on this house, sometimes a vacant house that makes it two mortgages for you. You know, is it really worth, if you have to wait 6 months and you're paying $2,000 a month, you know, is it really worth it? And then to come to find out you're going to have to sell it at market value anyways. That's just how it is.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Unless it's like a unicorn house.
Well, this brings me to the emotional intelligence thing in general. When we talk about emotional intelligence in training, it's so funny. I have this definition. I've had to change the definition on my slide because I got pushback on that too. Because the definition is along the lines of being able to manage and control your own emotions and the emotions of others. It's a pretty simple kind of, that's what it is simply. But I did get pushback once. Some male CEO. I mean, I love my men and I love my CEOs, but I'm going to pick on them a little bit because I'm determined to get them more emotionally intelligent. He said, well, I think it's impossible to control other people's emotions. And I was like, okay, let me rephrase it.
I would have to agree, though.
I agree. I said, okay, manage and control your own emotions and manage and motivate other emotions. Yes, you cannot control other people's emotions. You can control yours. But first it starts with you have to understand your own emotions before you can actually empathize and understand other people's emotions. And when you're not tapped into your own emotions, how can you possibly be emotionally intelligent?
Right. And maybe it's more like manage and influence other people's emotions.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I have a buyer that I've been working with who is super duper emotional because she needs a house and we've been having trouble finding the right thing. And I've had to influence her emotions and manage them to keep pulling her back to really seeing, you know, what we've got to do here and helping her like be more logical, like pull her out of being too emotional and respecting those emotions because they're invalidating them, you know, but saying, okay, it's not going to help for you to freak out. So let's just look at the facts again. Let's relook at everything. Let's figure out, is there a compromise? Like, you know, it's a management and also like a, not controlling, but influencing for sure.
Mm-hmm.
By your own intelligence and not me trying to manage my own frustration of like, oh my God, you know, I have to manage that and be like, empathize and, you know, try to put myself in her shoes and also to try not to control the situation.
Yeah. And it goes back to if you can self-empathize and you understand where you're coming from, it's easy to recognize the emotions and triggers of others. So it comes down to triggers as well. What has triggered someone in anything, in a relationship, in a buying and selling relationship? Something will cause a behavioral reaction because something triggered them from another time in their life when mm-hmm. you're not even aware of what that is. And how do you become aware of what that is? I mean, unless you get to know people better to find out what makes them tick.
Right. Or another way maybe would be if somebody's getting triggered in your life, if it's a client or a personal relationship and you're noticing they get triggered, then kind of like start tracking, okay, what was the situation? What was the topic? What did I say anything that mm-hmm. I like as a pattern of something that I say that could yeah. possibly be the trigger? And then you can kind of back out of it probably and maybe figure out, you might not be able to, you know, get that person to not be triggered by that certain thing, but you
right.
can control
right.
how, if you say that triggering phrase or, you know, maybe avoid that subject.
that actually reminds me, there was an article I read just this morning. Hold on, I want to pull it up because it was really interesting. It was a real quick article, but it had these three phrases that you should avoid. People who use these three toxic phrases have very low emotional intelligence. And it's a Inc. article, and I'll find the, I'll put the link in the show notes. So here's one, a phrase you shouldn't use. Can't you just? So it's along the lines of, I'm going to read some of this article. She says, I wasn't a parent at the time, but immediately understood the reason. She singled out the phrase in a question. Okay, can't you just? Anderson talked about a single mom friend venting about how hard it was to get one kid ready for school in the morning while the other waited. Another mom talked about, she says, can't you just set out some crayons or crafty stuff? Another mom suggested that'll keep them busy. Another mom talked about how she wished she had enough time to make home-cooked dinners each night. Can't you just prep the meals on the weekends and then reheat them during the week? Someone suggested. I wanted to yell, can't you just stop asking the poor mom all these unhelpful questions? So she goes on to say, it's obvious and simple. A quick deconstruction of can't you just shows that it's normally used in response to someone else's articulation of a problem, but that the phrasing suggests that whatever brilliant idea you're going to propose next is obvious and simple. Oh, can't you just, right? That triggers and you don't even realize. Like when I read these phrases, I'm like, oh yeah, I can see how you think you're being helpful, but they're feeling judged.
Yeah. And they're like basically saying, aren't you, you're a little too stupid to realize how simple it is.
So Exactly.
Thank God I arrived to tell you how stupid you are exactly. and to present this amazing solution
yeah.
that you probably already fucking tried.
Right. Exactly. that would mean that if the person you're talking to hasn't thought of this obvious and simple solution and implemented, then he or she is to blame for the underlying problem. Mm. So that's, you know, that's how someone is going to perceive it. And this is also coming from a book called EQ Applied by Justin Bariso. I want to get that book now. So the next phrase, I know how you feel, right? I have been guilty of saying that. I know how you feel.
And what's toxic about that?
Think about it for a second. Oh, I know how you feel.
Well, and you never really know how somebody feels. I've said it before, and then I usually backtrack and say, actually, I really don't know how you feel, but I have been in a similar situation. But it's, yeah. I mean, tell me more about what they say about it, Gina.
So it says, nobody can truly understand exactly how someone else feels, but suggesting that you can quickly dismisses the other person's perception and focuses the attention on yourself. Yeah, I have been called out for this before, where it's like, well, it feels like you just made it about yourself when I'm trying to tell you something I'm going through right now. I just want you to listen. I don't want to hear that you've gone through it.
That's a good point. It's a really good point.
I'd rather you say everything's going to be okay. You got this. I don't care about what you're going through when I'm going through my own shit. You know what I mean? Like, I think that in general for human beings, like, oh, good for you. You went through that. Whatever. You know what I mean?
I do.
It says, I know to some people this sounds like touchy-feely emotional pulp, but if you want to connect with people, communicate empathy, and be a leader, it's worth the attention. She has one more phrase that she's trying to banish. It's basically any variation of when you ask someone a question intended to show you care and then immediately follow it with a suggestion of what the right answer should be. So there's some of these variations. It's a variation of how's it going? Everything's great, right? How's the family? Doing well? How was your first day of work? Happy? Everybody in your department has what they need? Yes? All right, so you're asking a question, you're answering it.
But you don't actually really want to hear the answer.
Yes. Yeah. So it's technically you're just asking, maybe. But the person you're talking to will often hear it as something more prescribed. I'm going to ask you this and you're going to answer that.
Yeah.
It's like you're driving it to get them to, like, you're telling me how you want me to answer you.
Right. Rather than asking, how are you?
Yeah.
And then letting them answer.
Yeah. But so that's a big part of emotional intelligence is the self-awareness piece. First, you have to be self-aware. And then you have to be socially aware of what's going on around you and how people are, and how are people perceiving you? What's the bigger picture? So perception is reality for some people.
Perception is reality for all people, I would say.
Yeah. It's their perception of you.
Yeah, and a lot of times we think that we're being helpful because it's the way we see it, but it's just not helpful at all to the other person because they're right. Like, well, you're just kind of being an asshole, or you have no idea how I feel, like to that second point there, or you don't understand at all and clearly you don't want to. Like all of those fallacies and mistakes, and sometimes it's completely oblivious because you're caught up in your own perception of reality and you're like,
right,
hardly listening.
A couple years ago, and I know she doesn't listen, so I can talk about her. I had somebody, a vendor who was working for me, who, this is like right after I got, like, it was right after my whole anemia scare and in and out of the hospital. It was like in 2016. And it was a challenging time. If you recall, it was not an easy time for me going through all that because I was in and out of the hospital several times. And so this vendor who had been working for me for years said, I can't work with you anymore. I can't work with you anymore. You're too negative for me, and the things you put on Facebook are too negative for me, and I can't work for you anymore. And I'm gonna block you on Facebook, and I don't want it. I know you're gonna talk bad about me. Like, I was all these crazy stories she was telling herself. I'm like, hey, why would I talk bad about you on Facebook? That would make me look like an asshole, for one. But she had this really visceral reaction to me that I could not understand for the life of me. And then I really kind of had to dial in to try to see, like, where was she coming from? And I think, and this is the story I tell myself, because obviously I can verify it for sure. But she had been going through her own health issues. And she had a cancer scare, and she at one point had cancer, and she was going through some other tests at that same moment in time that I was going through medical tests. And I think potentially, and this is like, how do we empathize? And I could be completely wrong with it, but I think maybe because I had been kind of chronicling my journey on Facebook of what I was going through, like, oh, this is what happened. And I think maybe that might have triggered her, that it was bringing up other emotions for her that she didn't want. Because one of her comments to me was, you know, I've had amazing experiences at our local hospital. Just because you haven't doesn't mean that they're not good. I was like, whoa, okay, all right, okay. Well, I almost died, so that was my experience in the hospital going into septic shock. But that was sort of my aha, like, how do you drill through that something I did triggered her?
Well, and another thing is that sometimes we think that we are being so helpful, and sometimes people don't really want the advice, like, or they don't want to, they like you said earlier, they just want to be heard. And it comes, like, using those phrases that you just mentioned makes, I think everybody wants to, like, be seen as knowledgeable and be seen as helpful and, like, especially stuff that have experience with, but sometimes it just, like, comes across as being a know-it-all, and nobody really likes a know-it-all. And we do tend to make it about ourselves. I know I'm super guilty about that. I think I've gotten better about it in a lot of things, especially in business, about making it about myself. Like, I used to just ramble on about myself all the time. And then I finally realized, oh God, this is not about me. But it's still hard to do because people love to talk about themselves more than they like to talk about anything else.
It's true.
And so when you see something, you know, on, especially now social media, if you put a comment about anything on social media, then just be prepared, because then the whole world is going to have an opinion on it. Now, oh, it's God, one yeah. thing if you ask for advice, then you're asking for it. But sometimes, you know, like perhaps using the example of you chronicling your situation with anemia, you're just putting it out there for information of loved ones who might want to know. And it's an easy way to, you know, spread it around quickly, or just to share the experience. But then
or to help others. Right.
Right.
So kind of my thing was like, if I don't want anyone, I want other people to have an easier time through it.
Right.
But when we circle this back around, well, maybe people don't want to hear that.
Maybe they don't. And maybe also the people see it and they're like, oh, well, this is my experience. They love to do that. I do it too. I do it, especially like you see somebody and they're like freaking out about something on social, or they're, you know, asking about it or bitching about it. And you're like, oh yeah, me too. I da 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 da.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And then they're like, why is she chiming in? This is about me, not about you.
And I think I heard something. Hi, Audrey. Thanks. That's Audrey, the famous loudmouth cat.
You know, we should just put a picture of her in all of our marketing.
She used to always be in my fitness stuff. Last night, I heard this great quote. And let me see if I can. And it was just somebody. He said, it's never a bad idea to just keep your mouth shut. And I was like, damn, that's so true. I mean, and I'm not talking in a situation where you're in a dangerous situation and you're not saying something about it. I'm talking about when you think, you know, here's another phrase that I heard a long time ago, and I just love this one. Opinions are like assholes.
Yes.
Everybody has one, but that does not mean that we would like to see yours.
Yes.
You know, and it's... I really, that phrase that he said last night, I will take with me for a long time, is like, it's never a bad idea to keep your mouth shut. And that circles around to that the money is made in the silence of sales, that from the moment I burst out of the womb, I'm pretty sure I've had trouble keeping my fucking mouth shut. So I'm still working on that. Not through with that journey.
You may never be.
No, I won't. And that's okay.
I mean, I have resigned to that fact for myself. I just sometimes don't know when to shut the fuck up.
Yeah, well, that's talkative people. And then, you know, then there's the opposite side of people that are never courageous enough to speak. So, you know, it's part of being human. I'm convinced that humans are just fucked. We're all crazy and we're all working our way through it. So, you know, have empathy for that for all others.
Were you the kid in school? Because I was the kid in school where when my mom would go for a parent-teacher conference and the teacher would say, she's really bright, but she talks too much.
Oh, absolutely. I used to get the, when I was in school, I remember really clearly that I'd get, we used to have like S or U, satisfactory, unsatisfactory, uh-huh. like in early. And I would always have unsatisfactory on self-control. And going back to my dance teachers, like I have always been super passionate about dance. And I would run my fucking mouth all the time because I was so excited in class. And they'd have to tell me shut up 100 times. Like, it's no different clearly right now.
You know, and I think about that because we think about, you know, if you're talking about raising children, like if I were a mom and you are a mom, but if I were a mom and I think about, God, if I had a kid like me, that would be scary. But also, you know, you look at how do those kids like us end up here we are, right? And think that we can still end up pretty good even though we're that talkative and talk too much, because I think at the same time we're constantly on a journey to be learning and to be better and self-development and self-awareness. And so to your point, okay, I'm still a work in progress on this, and I will always be a work in progress on this.
And I think the danger is when people think that they aren't, and they're like, well, I'm the freaking cat's meow and I'm good the way I am. Or the other fixed mindset idea of, well, this is just how I am.
Well, you know, it's interesting that just actually triggered my thought since you said the word fixed mindset. We did interview Dr. Eve Masita, and that's a podcast that's coming up after this one, a couple weeks after this one posts. And she talks about that fixed versus growth mindset. And that was a really big aha for me, because people who are in such a fixed mindset of this is how it is, these are the cards that were dealt, and this is how it is, and nothing is changing. Like that's unfortunate, because I think you have to always be evolving and you always have to tap into that. And I think someone in a fixed mindset cannot have very good emotional intelligence.
No, because they're certainly not really in tune with themselves if they're just really in that fixed thing, because everything's changing. I mean, if you go down to a molecular level of everything on the planet and you look at our human bodies, like your certain ones of your cells are they're replacing each other. They're replacing themselves every day, you know, within a 24-hour period. I read this the other day, within a 24-hour period, like from your entire digestive tract replaces all the interior lining cells. So if you think of it on a molecular level, that we're constantly changing and evolving and within our own bodies, then why doesn't it make sense to want to constantly be evolving your mindset and who you are, you know, who are you, rather than just, this is my body. And it goes for your physical shape. Like you don't have to just be a fat person or a skinny person. Like, it's just constantly changing if you want. You don't have to be an asshole your whole life. You can decide you just are tired of being that and then figure out how to change it. You don't have to be shy. You can work on skills to be more courageous. Like, you know, there are options, but I think it's just a choice to just say, I think I want to make a change. Gonna make a change.
I didn't know we were doing karaoke today.
Once in my life.
It's time for some karaoke.
We definitely need to do carpool karaoke for sure. For sure. Yeah, for sure. We could get on the loop.
Yeah. Let's ask the Warners. Do you want to hear us do karaoke? And what songs would you like to hear?
Yes. I'm game for anything.
Seriously, I'm putting the ask out there. To see if anyone's listening to this episode. And we will dedicate those songs to you. So if you suggest a song, we will karaoke it and then we will dedicate it to you. I just committed Rachel to that without asking her.
I totally will sing anything. And in fact, my past lives, I have sang everything from opera, country, rap. I was once in a band and I had to sing a rap song, and I will never forget the day when I was like in this club in front of like all these rap guys and stuff. And here I come.
Can you rap?
No, but I did.
Do some.
No, not that kind of rap. Just, it was like a Missy Elliott, that Missy Elliott song back in the day, you know.
Oh, how does that song go?
The song, Work It.
You gotta work.
No,
that's RuPaul.
Is it worth it? Maybe work it. Whatever, how that one goes. Missy Elliott. It's very wordy, and I was terrified. But I digress. Any song you got, I'm not scared. I've sung at least one or two in my life.
We're not scared.
Mm-mm. And we're also not pretty good singers.
We are pretty good singers.
Yes, we are.
We need to schedule karaoke.
Yep.
And karaoke.
Indeed.
So, back to emotional intelligence. In business and in sales, if you want to be successful in life in general, you need to be more emotionally intelligent. There's a lot of great books out there. I also wrote a blog on it, and we should just repurpose that blog and put it on our website. But there's a blog at GinaTremarco.com on emotional intelligence and selling. But there's some really great books out there. Jeb Blunt, who I'm determined to get on this show if I keep begging him. He's got Sales EQ. I don't want to butcher it. And then there's Travis Bradbury, his book, Emotional Intelligence 2.0. So there's some really good books out there that kind of walk you through the process. I say check that out.
Yeah, and if you're somebody that is wondering, has never delved into your own emotional intelligence, I think going back to... Audrey is trying to chime in.
Audrey is very emotional right now.
She is. She thinks she needs food, I think. If you don't know where to start, then just start with yourself. Like, you don't have to pick up a book on emotional intelligence, even though that's a great, great idea. You just pick up a book about yourself, or like try something like meditation and try looking inward, because that's where it all starts. If you can't understand your own emotions and feelings, then you can't understand others well.
Yeah.
You can muck through it, but you might not be great at it.
I have an idea. I have a triggers worksheet that I use in training. I should somehow give that away. Somehow. How do we do that? Put it on our website or email me, maybe?
Women@womenyourmotherwarnsyouabout.com.
Yeah. You can email women@womenyourmotherwarnsyouabout.com. And I do have a triggers worksheet that walks you through literally, like, you write down the very specific scenarios that you've been through. Like the example I put in there is like, Bob is always late for the meeting. And so that's like the situation. And then you have to like identify the emotion you were feeling about it, and like what you were thinking about it, and what was it that you needed that caused you to react the way you reacted. And so when you walk through that exercise, you start to figure out what your triggers are. And for me, a trigger is disrespect. When someone disrespects my time or disrespects my knowledge, that triggers me. And then I have to remember to like tap in and be like, all right, just because I'm feeling disrespected doesn't necessarily mean they're disrespecting me. Mm-hmm. So it's those types of things that you need to be really aware of. That people's behavior are not necessarily what you think they are. It's just your, again, once again, perception is reality. Anyway, triggers exercise if anybody wants that worksheet.
Indeed. Fabulous.
Anything else? You got anything else for me?
Not on emotional intelligence. I think, you know, it's a lifelong process and it can be very rewarding. I know that I think that I do better business now that I have better emotional intelligence. Definitely, because again, as aforementioned, I tend to talk about myself all the time, and you know, I realized how much better business was going once I realized that the best sales are made when you make it about the buyer, you make it about the client or prospect. Just make it all about them. What do they need? And then they feel that from you, that you really care.
Yeah, and that's a great way to build trust really fast. Just care. Care, and what was it? Care and communication?
Mm-hmm.
Care and communication. I think you summed that up. Well, those are our nuggets today, Warners.
I bet you feel more emotionally intelligent right now already.
Well, I guess it's time for us to wrap up.
Let's wrap it.
It's nice because we haven't had some time, just you and me. I love our guests and I love Keith, but we just needed you and me. It's time to go. Do we have an outro or do we want to make it up?
We do have an outro. You wrote an outro.
I know. I can't find it.
It's the same as it usually is. Just read the other one then.
Okay. I think I'm saying, hey. Thanks to all of our Warners for listening to this episode of Women Your Mother Warned You About. So great to have you. If you want to connect with me directly or learn more about Pivot 10 Results and Carolina Improv, you can visit GinaTremurco.com. And for Rachel,
you can find me all over social media as Rachel on Real Estate. Or you can visit TheClosingCurve.com for your free How to Buy a Home Guide. If you're looking for a house, you can go to rachelonrealestate.com and search for homes there.
Ta-da. Sweet.
And find all of our social media links, including how to reach the famous, but not here today, Keith Walters, and some cool free downloads, which will soon include the triggers worksheet that Gina mentioned, on our website at womenyourmotherwarnedyouabout.com.
And if you haven't had a chance to give us a rating and review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast, we would really appreciate it if you did, because the more reviews we have, the more found we get, the better our content gets, yada, yada, yada. So go and do that. And we are running, some sort of promotion, like giving away earpods or something. You could actually go learn about that on our Facebook page, because when this episode runs, I believe that promotion will still be running. So if you give a review, you get a chance to win some, what are they called? AirPods. That's what they're called. I don't know. I don't have an iPhone. Anyway, just remember, for the best relationships, keep it real, raw, and relevant.
And a little irreverence doesn't hurt either.
Bye, Warners.
This really will get serious soon.
Yeah, it doesn't have to. I don't think anybody wants it to be serious.
This has been a presentation of the Sell or Die Network. For more podcasts that you can take out into the street and turn into money, visit SellorDieNetwork.com.